This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a new poll shows Blacks are very unsatisfied with the U.S. criminal justice system. A salute to Nelson Mandela at New York's Riverside Church, and a campaign to reinstate Dr. Anthony Montero at Temple University in Pennsylvania.
But first, Michael Dunn, a 47-year-old white man, was convicted of conspiracy to murder in the assault on four young black men that left 17-year-old Jordan Davis dead. However, the jury deadlocked on the first-degree murder charge. Prosecutors say they will press for a new trial on the murder charge. Dunn claimed that he was only defending himself when he fired 10 shots at the young black men's car. Aletta Austin Toure of the New Jim Crow Network followed the trial closely. She says Dunn is guilty of a savage racist attack.
It was ill will. It was hatred. It was spite. It was an evil intent. It was indifference to human life. He was angry prior to defendant. He said, "I hate that thug music," which meant his blood started to boil, which meant Dunn rolled down his window and asked them to turn it down. And any 17-year-old black kid, it didn't even have to be Jordan, any 17-year-old black kid deciding not to listen to him and turn the music down, it meant that he was going to shoot them. And it was 10 shots, point-blank range, from the window right next to their car on the passenger side. The boys were too close to get out their car. It was a 9mm. He shot at their body mass, not shooting at the tires or the ear. It was in the middle of the doors. The boys were ducking, trying to save their lives. This was 6 pounds of pressure per trigger pull. And what does that mean? This overview is that he was aiming at Jordan Davis. The attention is at Jordan. And Dunn, who was the killer, his own admission on the stand, he said he was trying to de-escalate the situation. Why is a non-cop vigilante in charge of de-escalating the situation? It's very important that we look at this like Zimmerman's case. And so the physical evidence showed the first three shots, like I mentioned, and the back seat near the seat belt was one of the shots, then towards the plastic where the lock is, which is why he couldn't get out, even if he tried. The medical examiner said the first penetrating shot, it went right through his right side, through his liver and his ribs, penetrating. The second shot was through his groins. The third shot entering back right side of his buttocks. It proved he was sitting up. So there wasn't a gun or any other object. He was sitting up. He didn't know it was coming. Then Leland tried to pull his friend over away from the door where the shots were coming from because it just kept coming. And, you know, the question is, could Jordan have been out of the car? There is no way. He was bent over trying by that time to escape from the killer. The boys came back to the car from inside of the store. That's the other boys. The officer Holmes opened the door. He found Grunts and his friend holding Jordan's head. So he went on the other side where Jordan's door was, and that's where his rear end was opened up. He knew the blood coming out of his body was coming from the buttock shot, and that's consistent with the medical examiner. Then three more shots were fired as the boys drove off trying to get away. He continued to fire. The proof is Dunn didn't care who he was going to kill. If he could kill another boy, he would have done it. And shot three was over the passenger seat towards the rear. Was this premeditated? Of course. We better believe it. We know this. The rolling his window down, it took Rhonda 1.36 seconds is what they said to get back in the car. So after the rolling of the window, how do we know it was premeditated as far as time reflection? He asked Jordan, "Are you talking to me?" And then Dunn replied, "You're not going to talk to me that way." This is proof that he heard Jordan loud and clear because he said he didn't hear him. Michael Dunn's behavior is truly important. The behavior at the fact shows that his intent was at the time. Incriminating evidence said that Sean Atkins, which is the homeless guy that took the tag number down, he went into the store right there at the gate to write the number down. Dunn had no reason to hide at the hotel or car. He said he had to go get his dog. It was more important than calling 911, more important to see if anybody was hurt. So if he doesn't know what's happening, why would he keep shooting? Shoot at the backs of the unarmed teens as they're coming out. He was scared of the blind fire. This is something in his imagination. You know, how can you be scared of the gunfire? There's no guns shooting back at him. Dunn intentionally committed this act, which would resulted in the death. Dunn acted on this. The weighing of the evidence wantonly and maliciously is what they asked the jury to look up when they're deliberating. Look up what wantonly means and maliciously means. This was not a TV show. It was not a crime scene from CSI. So the truth are lies, and this is very good. It gives it 10 points. The 10 points are testimony in court. Number one, he said, I heard loud thumping music. The inconsistency. She got out and said, after she heard the music, and then she got on the stand, his fiance, and said, I think that's what I meant. She changed it around. Number two, two young men with menacing expressions is what Dunn said. Then instead the inconsistency was, I don't know how many kids there were in there. Number three, he made his intention very clear. Number three, he was inconsistent by saying, I don't know what his intentions were. Number four, he said he stepped out of the car. Number three inconsistency was then he said later he opened the door. Okay. Number five, probably had three to four drinks, he said, because of the wedding. And the inconsistency was I had a toast at the wedding only. Number six, something cracker, he said. Then he never tells this to the detectives. Then number seven, he said, I should have fucking killed that motherfucker. He never tells this to the detectives. Then he slammed whatever it was against the door, meaning he had a weapon, but he never told that to the detectives. Number nine, this shit is going down, is what he said Jordan say, but he never told that to the detectives. And lastly, he said that Jordan said, you're not going to kill me, you son of a bitch. And then he never tells the detectives that. That's 10 testimonies in court versus his inconsistencies. So all of this about the conspiracy Mr. Dunn talks about. Kevin, Leland, Tommy, boys are embellishing. That's what he said. It's a conspiracy. Then he said something about the conspiracy because the 911 calls. Then there was a conspiracy for Steve Smith, who was there. Then there was a conspiracy from Sean Atkins, the homeless guy who got the tag number. Then the law enforcement was a conspiracy. Then the ETS. The Dr. Simmons medical examination is a conspiracy. And lastly, he said that Rhonda, his own fiance, she's the only one that knew him. She also had a part in this conspiracy. The boys returned to gate when they realized that their friend was dying, which proved they didn't have a gun. They wouldn't have come back if they had something. And so this whole thing about you're not going to talk to me that way, the action to get his gun, the shoot to kill, the 6 pounds trigger, 10 bullets, mindset as indicated by his statement of superiority, the behavior after the fact, two grown human beings would gauge their behavior around a dog's bowel movement to go back to the hotel. So what we're saying is because of these points, Dunn does not get to claim self-defense. There's just no way.
You had the opportunity to make a presentation to 500 young, aspiring black lawyers, law students, and many of them were from out of state. What was their reaction to this racial and legal environment in Florida?
Just like everyone else's should be today, we cannot allow another Zimmerman to go free. We cannot allow the self-defense that was made up in this Confederate South that will not allow a black boy to live in our lives in this country with the prison industrial complex, with the disproportionate minority contact. They understand the realness of being a lawyer after the 50 years of the March on Washington. Is imperative that we make the changes to not have another boy to die like Trayvon and like Jordan.
That was Aletta Austin-Toure in Jacksonville, Florida.
It's been almost 2 years since George Zimmerman snuffed out Trayvon Martin's life in Sanford, Florida. We asked Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network how his organization will mark the occasion.
It's being marked on February 26th, which will be 2 years since Trayvon's murder. There's been a call for a day of outrage and remembrance that's been issued by the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And people are taking it up in cities across the country L.A., San Francisco, Dallas, Texas, up here in New York, and other places are making plans, and that's being put up on the website of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And folks should go to that site and check to see what's happening. That site is stopmassincarceration.net, because it's 2 years, but what was at issue in the murder of Trayvon Martin is very much still with us. And that is, do black youth have to go through their lives with a target on their back, one that could be used for target practice by the police and has been used for target practice by the police, or for any old white racist who decides they want to take out a black kid? And when I say that, I am not engaging in hype, because we do have to talk about Renisha McBride, gunned down by a white homeowner while searching help. We got to talk about Jordan Davis, who was murdered by Michael Dunn because Dunn did not like the kind of music and how loud that music was being played. And he saw that it was four black youth playing it. So he decided that, as he said in court, my life was in danger. I could see this kid getting out of the car with a gun that did not exist and never existed. But because he was looking at black faces, he feels that it is legitimate to talk about fear and say that I fired in self-defense, including the fact that he fired at the vehicle as it was fleeing. So this is what we're dealing with, and that underscores the urgency of people remembering how they felt when they learned that Trayvon was murdered and his killer was not arrested, and how they felt again when, after weeks of mobilization, forced the authorities to put the killer on trial, he was found not guilty. And they were basically saying that black people have no rights that white people are bound to respect. And we must say this is unacceptable.
Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network.
Blacks gave the criminal justice system low marks in a survey conducted by the Emerson College Poland Society in Boston. Felix Chen is founder and chief analyst of the poll, which is conducted by students using professionally recognized methodologies. Chen says black people think race relations in the United States are getting worse.
There is a huge divide among different racial groups. So for African Americans, 61% believe race relations are worse compared to 41% Caucasians. And if we ask another question about whether American justice system is biased against minorities, 69% of African Americans said the justice system is biased against minority, but only 28% of Caucasians said the system is biased. So as you can see through our survey, clearly, people with different race groups in America, they view justice, they view equalities very differently.
What did you find in terms of Hispanics? Are their perceptions of the world closer to blacks or to Caucasians?
If we look back to the question, like if race relation is getting better or worse in the U.S., 42% of Hispanic said it's getting worse. They're still more aligned with the white population in the U.S. African-Americans has a really strong feeling about race relations in the U.S. One of the most interesting things I found is the perception of race relation really depends on what race you are. So it doesn't really matter whether you're female or male, whether you are older or you're younger. It seems which race category you're in really determines how you think about race relation in the U.S. There's not a really strong correlation for like parties and genders and age, but your race and ethnicity determines your opinion on race.
And were you and your fellow students surprised at the vast racial chasm in perceptions of the United States?
Once you look at the numbers, especially in regards to the court system, that's what really struck me, like over the whole survey. Yes, they're most concerned about the fairness and the process of the court system.
In 2009 and 2010, the Pew Research pollsters found that black people were more optimistic about their place in society and about the health of the economy than any other ethnic group. Your poll shows black folks seeming to be more pessimistic about their chances for advancement in society and the basic fairness of American society.
I think if you look at the Pew poll, they're asking whether American people are optimistic about the future of the U.S., the whole aspect of the U.S. economy. And if you think about 2009, 2010, like President Obama was elected as the president of the United States, the first African-American in the history. So I feel like that really brought a lot of the excitement and just, you know, hope for the African-American community. And in this specific poll, it was conducted recently, and then with the story of Trayvon Martin, with a lot of the racially engaged events, it definitely, you know, sheds a light about how these relations might not improve compared to 4 years ago.
That was Felix Chan of the Emerson College Polling Society in Boston.
The battle is on once again for the soul of the African American Studies Department at Temple University in Philadelphia. Temple's Dean of Liberal Arts, Teresa Soufis, refused to renew Dr. Anthony Monteiro's contract after consulting with Department Chairman Molefi Asante. Only months before, the dean had threatened to fire Asante. It was Dr. Monteiro who rallied community and student resistance to the administration. Dr. Monteiro says the dean's conduct has been thoroughly racist.
This firing was preceded by a series of actions that, if directed towards any group other than black people generally and black men in particular, would have been cause for Dean Soufis' removal. Her statement that she did not see a black community, pointing her finger in Molefi Asante's face in a manner reminiscent of Jim Crow racism and slavery, sending an email to our past departmental chair stating that myself, Drs. Stanford and Wonkior, should not even think we were competitive to apply for a tenure-track position. The harassment, bullying, and driving from the university, Drs. Lewis Gordon and his wife Jane Gordon, her turning down the vote of our faculty to appoint Dr. Kariama Welsh, a full professor, recognized dance scholar, and twice chair of the dance department as interim chair of our department, her push to make a white woman scholar chair over the objections of the majority of our faculty and students, her belligerent attitude and hostile body language when meeting with our faculty, her denying me the right to advise grad students and their dissertations in violation of accepted practice, which is so common that the procedure is institutionalized. This culminated in her letter of January 6, 2014, telling me my contract would not be renewed after the current semester. She gave no reason and only said I should contact the chair of my department for further explanation. In fact, the only explanation I've received thus far appeared in the Philadelphia Tribune, where she said my firing had to do with, quote, a change of direction, end quote, in the department. After more than 10 years of teaching, mentoring, service to the university and the department, I was told via the news media that my services were no longer needed because of a change of direction and, quote, an exciting new curriculum, end quote. She mentioned nothing of my scholarship, teaching, and community service or mentoring. The question is, why not? The answer is that this is nothing less than a retaliatory and revenge firing. It is her getting back at me for my standing up to her bullying, pointing fingers at black men, her authoritarian attempt to take over African-American studies, and my taking the struggle for the life and integrity of our department to the black community, those to whom we are ultimately accountable. I am a scholar and an activist. My life and work is guided by the moral imperative to stand for justice, to work to end poverty, homelessness, and hunger, to fight to end mass incarceration and for justice and freedom for political prisoners and prisoners of conscience, to end war and to save the earth and humanity from a climatic catastrophe. My scholarship, as is well known, is anchored in the intellectual and moral courage of W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yes. Yes, yes.
The unflinching opposition to war, racism, and poverty of Martin Luther King Jr. The wisdom of Ella Baker and the witness of James Baldwin.
Yes.
I teach them and write about them and try to live like them.
Yes.
And need I say I come from, am organically tied to and ultimately accountable to the great Afro-American people and their mighty strivings for freedom. This moral and intellectual positioning is viewed by some in the academy as outside the bounds of legitimate academic work. It is seen as threatening and certainly a challenge to the idea that higher education exists to make profit rather than uphold and teach human values. I ask, is not the social historical grounding of African American studies the Afro-American people? Is not the basis of our phenomenology the humanity of the Afro-American people? Do these not then compel us to unconditional solidarity with our people? If we reject the centrality of the Afro-American people to what we do and what we teach and who we are, should we just fold up our tents, go home, and call ourselves something other than African-American studies? We are now at a moment of truth. It is an existential moment. It is what Martin Luther King spoke of in his famous sermon, Three Dimensions of a Complete Life. We can choose to either stand for justice or be indifferent to it. We can choose, at our collective peril, I might say, selfishness and egotism over service and the undeniable recognition that an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. What affects me today will certainly be your fate tomorrow. And if you are a black person, what makes you think your loyalty to injustice now will protect you from the same evil tomorrow? We are compelled to break the betrayal of our silences. I have been unjustly fired. I have been publicly spoken of as a non-entity whose teaching, scholarship, and service have meant little, practically nothing to the university and the department. There's scores of people who can replace me, I'm told. After all, you don't have tenure. But is that all there is to it? And some will ask, Dr. Montero, why are you choosing the path of resistance and protest rather than accepting your fate and going quietly into the night?
My God.
Isn't that what others in your position do? Temple University and its dean are too powerful. They don't retreat on things like this. This dean is too invested in getting you out of Temple. How do we, the people, fight such a powerful institution as Temple? Can't they buy off those who would be your allies? My only answer is there's more to this than Temple and me. The question is what is right, what is moral, and how can we serve the cause of justice? In the process, how do we transform a powerful institution into a great one? Moreover, to make Temple a great university, we must resituate it as a force for good and service to the people, especially the poor, and especially its neighbors. And we must defend the rights and dignity of all employees of Temple. I agree with Martin Luther King. We can all be great because we can all serve. By standing up, I believe I'm serving my community, my people, the great Afro-American people, Temple University, and all who stand for justice. It is far larger than me. It's also about the children in Nara's homes right next to Temple. It's about the human beings that inhabit the two poorest zip codes in Philadelphia, which are neighbors to Temple. It's about them. It's about the kids harassed by the police and told, keep it moving, you don't belong here. It's about the closing down of Saturday free schools and W.E.B. Du Bois lectures and symposia that open the classroom and lecture halls to the poor and working class. In this whole thing, I am but a part, an instrument, if you will. Yet it is this mix, as my friend Sakai Rhodes reminds me, my ancestral obligation to stand at this time in this place.
Right.
I did nothing wrong. I have served the university and its neighbors. Ask my students.
Yes.
Ask people in the neighborhood, near and far from Temple. I served and lived up to my contractual agreements. Mm-hmm. Now we must fight. Mm-hmm. Now is the time.
Right.
Our demands are simple. One, reinstate me with tenure. Two, end the harassment, retaliation, and bullying of others and myself. Allow me to perform my duties as a scholar and activist. Three, restore my right to reserve rooms and lecture halls for lectures, conferences, symposia, the Saturday free school and film showings.
That's right.
And four, yes, an apology from Dean Sufis, defamation of my character, and the belittling of my intellectual and professional achievements. Thank you very much.
Dr. Anthony Montero, speaking at a press conference in the Philadelphia offices of the Hospital Workers Union.
State Representative W. Curtis Thomas was also at the press conference. Thomas represents Northern Philadelphia, where Temple University is located, and Dr. Montero was born and raised.
I met with Dr. Malafia Sante. He did not say anything that lended itself to the university's failure to renew Dr. Montero's contract and renew the contract of another scholar at the university. And the only thing I can tell you about Dr. Montero, and if the university didn't know, I guess they know now, that because you take advantage of his history, his skills, and his vision for the African Studies Department, doesn't mean that he's going to be your yes man. That's not going to happen. Nor should you think that he's going to go along just to get along. That will never happen when it comes to Dr. Montero. And it should not happen to Dr. Asante. And it should not apply to any African American man or woman who have worked hard, yes, to be where they are.
That was State Representative W. Curtis Thomas. Dr. Cornell West of New York's Union Theological Seminary is a firm supporter of Dr. Montero.
Brother Tony Montero is one of our grand intellectual freedom fighters who has been consistent decade after decade. He works in the tradition of W.B. Du Bois and C.L.R. James. And, of course, we should mention Brother Stuart Hall, who just passed this week, part of that same tradition, so that Brother Tony Montero is a very precious and a very powerful freedom fighter linked to the life of the mind. And so I just cannot conceive of why he was not only supported at Temple, but celebrated at Temple. That's why I'm in his corner 120%.
He's been there for 10 years. And just last year, there was a hell of a fight over the fate of the African American Studies Department, in which the community was brought in and Temple University was forced to back off of a plan to deny the department autonomy.
Absolutely. Well, now, I was just there in May. Brother Malafia Sante invited me to be part of his Afrocentric conference, and Brother Malafia gave a wonderful tribute to Brother Tony Montero, because Tony Montero had come to his defense in a very, very strong and effective manner. And so I was just struck all of a sudden when I looked up and said, well, wait a minute, Brother Montero is no longer there, and he's no longer being embraced in the way that he was just in May. And so I'm just so glad to see both his students as well as the community rise up and support Tony Montero.
And in fact, according to the story in the Philadelphia Tribune, Dr. Asante's reaction has been essentially, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. His year-to-year contract was up, and well, that's all there was to it.
No. We know there's got to be more to it than that. Lord have mercy. The cookie could have crumbled and gave that chairman of the African-American Studies Department somebody else other than Malafé. So it's not a matter of the cookie crumbling for me. It's a matter of us trying to be principled and consistent in both our commitment to intellectual work as well as our commitment to the kind of service to the community. And I think Brother Montero is a magnificent example of both intellectual work and service to the community.
What's this say about the status of African-American studies departments around the country and also the plight of adjunct professors who don't have tenure?
Well, there's no doubt that the proletarianization of the academy in terms of proliferation of adjunct professors is a form of economic exploitation. But Tony Montero, you see, he's been around even much more than the 10 years he was at Temple. His position before he was at Temple was a tenure equivalent position. When he came to Temple, he was coming just to be part of what was going on at Temple and to be part of the Philadelphia community, especially Philadelphia black community. And I always assumed he was tenured because he was always a distinguished colleague.
And of course, it's not just economic insecurity for adjunct professors who have political views is also a political insecurity.
Yeah, there's always an ideological element here. There's no doubt about that. And let us be clear that Brother Tony Montero, he is a revolutionary intellectual. And revolutionary intellectuals always have a hard time in the academy. I don't care what color the academicians are who have power over them.
Dr. Montero was most proud of bringing the surrounding black neighborhood of Philadelphia onto the campus and bringing the campus into the surrounding community.
Actually, he's one of the major figures in the country that deals with what we call town and gown, community and academy, the folk who are working day in and day out to make a living and the folk who are writing and reading day in and day out.
Dr. Cornel West of Union Theological Seminary in New York. Black Agenda Report Executive Editor Glenn Ford says Molefe Asante stabbed Dr. Montero in the back and betrayed the black community.
Temple University needs to be taught a lesson, and so does Dr. Molefe Asante, the professor who chairs the university's African American Studies Department. Both Temple University and Dr. Asante must be made accountable for their crimes of arrogance and disrespect to black Philadelphia and to African Americans at large. Temple University, an elite white-run institution, and Molefe Asante, a man who claims to be a disciple of Afrocentricity, have conspired to fire the brilliant public intellectual and activist Dr. Anthony Montero, who has been an associate professor in African American Studies for the past 10 years. We know why Temple University might resent Dr. Montero, who has worked tirelessly to bring the surrounding black community onto campus and to make the university more accountable to its black neighbors. It is to be expected that an elite white institution might be uncomfortable with a scholar like Dr. Montero, who organized on-campus events in defense of Mumia Abu-Jamal and other political prisoners. And it should come as no surprise that Temple's white overseers might not appreciate Dr. Montero's deep knowledge of and commitment to the black liberation struggle, that he lives what he teaches. In short, there is no mystery to Temple University's refusal to renew Dr. Montero's contract. It's called Racism in Higher Education 101, and we know how to deal with it. However, Dr. Molefe Asante's betrayal is much more hurtful. He has put his considerable prestige at the service of racists while stabbing Dr. Montero in the back and spitting in the face of every black Philadelphian who has had the misfortune to trust Asante. Last year, student and community protests forced the university to back off of a plan to take away the African American Studies Department's autonomy and to name a white woman with no expertise in the subject as chairperson. At least twice, Dr. Asante was threatened with firing. Instead, the community and student forces that Dr. Montero had helped summon won the day. With Dr. Montero's support, Dr. Asante was named department chairman. Just a few months later, the white female dean of liberal arts refused to renew Anthony Monteiro's contract, effectively firing him. What was Dr. Asante's response? Asante confirmed that the dean had consulted him about the firing and that his position was that Dr. Monteiro has a year-to-year contract and it's up to the dean. Then Asante shuffled like a minstrel in a dashiki. He said he couldn't worry about, quote, if somebody signs a contract and then gets upset when someone says your year is up. Dr. Asante may have earned the gratitude of his masters at Temple University, but his tenure as a person of respect in Black America is over. Asante is a backstabber who should never again be allowed into a position of Black trust, a grasping opportunist who apparently believes that Afrocentricity means everything revolves around him. The university's dean would not have fired Dr. Monteiro if she hadn't been confident that Uncle Asante had her back and that he would cover for the racist termination of his colleague. Therefore, two things must happen in this fight. One, Dr. Monteiro must be reinstated, and two, Molefi Asante must be shunned and expelled from the company of honest people for his treachery.
Among those at Dr. Monteiro's press conference last week was Dr. Johanna Fernandez, a history professor at New York's Baruch College and part of the defense team for the nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia recently provided an audio lecture to one of Dr. Fernandez's class. The subject was Reconstruction.
Dear fellow students, I thank you and your professor, Dr. Fernandez, for this brief opportunity to share some time with you as you study what I think was the pivotal point in time for the United States, Reconstruction. Most of us spend little time and perhaps less thought on this period, for, let's face it, it's ancient history, right? I can hear the rolling of eyes, the sucking sounds of mouths, the closing of minds, snapping shut, and the whispered thought, what does this have to do with me, all this stuff from the 1870s, 1880s? But Reconstruction is more than a word historians attach to an era. It was, for the first time in American life, a real attempt to change America's trajectory from a slave nation to a truly free nation. And that brave, noble attempt ended in failure and betrayal. Reconstruction, formally, refers to the years 1866 to 1876. Other historians and authors differ on these dates. These dates are bookmarks in time for when Congress began passing what were called the Reconstruction Acts, which became the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution and supportive legislation, and the congressional presidential deal that made Rutherford B. Hayes president on the condition that the U.S. Army be removed from Southern Territory, exposing African Americans to a deluge of white terrorism, most often organized by an army of the Democratic Party known as the Ku Klux Klan. Some will argue in protest that the South was defeated by the military power of the North. And while true, it doesn't tell all of the story. For what the military wins in the field, politicians can deal away at the table of negotiations. That's what happened in the Hayes-Tilden Compromise of 1876, when the Democratic candidate, Samuel Tilden, seemed to land more votes than Hayes. A congressional committee was established, and the Electoral College gave Hayes one more vote than Tilden. Hayes took the presidency and fulfilled a campaign promise to pull out the U.S. Army, actually tens of thousands of black troops, and Reconstruction came to a dirty, brutal end. In the recent book, The Day Freedom Died, The Colfax Massacre, The Supreme Court, and the Betrayal of Reconstruction by Charles Lane, we see clearly how all levels of government turned their faces from African Americans and left them to the cruel, tender mercies of their former tormentors and enslavers of the white South. Lane writes, "Instead of a new civil war, there had been a new compromise, a grand bargain between the white Republicans of the North and the white Democrats of the South. The latter had traded the presidency to the former in return for control over their own states. And that meant control of their colored population, because the Supreme Court had decreed that the Negroes must look first to the states for protection against violence and fraud. They must look to the likes of Wade Hampton and Francis Nichols." These were notorious racists. "The Compromise of 1877 was less formal than the Missouri Compromise or the Compromise of 1850, but its basic logic was similar. The Union was to be preserved at the risk of the rights of 4 million Americans of African descent. The Negro, the nation opined, will disappear from the field of national politics. Henceforth, the nation, as a nation, will have nothing more to do with him. Reconstruction was over." Charles Lane then adds a final observation. Quote, "The South pushed on Republican fault lines until they cracked. The Confederate States of America lost the Civil War militarily and economically, but in the ways that mattered most to white Southerners, socially, politically, and ideologically, the South did not. Ulysses S. Grant, then President of the United States, died on July 23, 1885, having tried but failed to secure the new birth of freedom for which he had fought the Civil War. Because the U.S. government ceded the issue of states' rights, or local power and control, for all intents and purposes, the South won the war to treat black people as slaves in everything but name. When a civil rights bill was passed in 1875, it would take less than 10 years for the Supreme Court to strike it down. Black people were free according to the Constitution, but in reality, their lives were virtually indistinguishable from that of their captive ancestors or even themselves. They could not vote. They could not hold office. They could not take certain jobs or professions. They were denied the right to travel from what used to be plantations. They were betrayed, and it would take a century to rebuild movements of the 1960s for voting rights, for so-called freedom. For the South had won the war politically, which they lost on the fields of Gettysburg. Thank you.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking from a prison in Frackville, Pennsylvania.
Hundreds gathered at New York's historic Riverside Church for a tribute to the late South African President Nelson Mandela. Among the speakers was Rodolfo Reyes Rodriguez, the Cuban ambassador to the United Nations. Ambassador Reyes was among the thousands of Cubans who fought in Angola against the army of white-ruled South Africa.
"As Mandela's life teaches us, only the concerted efforts of all nations will empower humanity to respond to the enormous challenges that today threaten its very existence. Cuba, a country born in the struggle for independence and for the abolition of slavery, and whose children have African blood in their veins, has had the privilege of fighting and building alongside the African nation. I would like to refer to some ideas why Cuba has been so involved in Africa, why we have been fighting side by side with our brothers from Africa, why now we are still sharing their future, and why we are working closely also in the provision of the right to life, right to food, right to education, and right to health. First of all, Cuba and its nation has been a result of a very important influence of Africa. The Cuban nation has very deep African roots, We need to recognize that the independence and the fight for independence of Cuba has been always very closely related to the fight for the abolition of slavery. After the experience in Haiti, when that was the first revolution and the first Latin American and Caribbean independent country in the region, in Cuba, they tried to create an important hate against African descendant persons, and they would like to always separate and segregate those people of European origin, all those that has been born in Cuba, and all those of African descent, in particularly because they know that the unity was the most important tool for the fight for independence. The first that took weapons to be fighting for the independence, the father of our nation, Carlos Manuel de Céspedes, the first act that he took was precisely to get the liberty for his own slaves. And then, when the revolution continued, precisely José Martí in the 90s, at the end of the century, showed that the only way is precisely to create a political party that was uniting anyone. It means that for Cuba, Africa is an issue that is in our blood, is in our history, and is one clear part of all our feeling, all our culture, all our anytime we are considering part of our neighborhood and part of our relative and part of our families. That was precisely when the Cuban Revolution win, and at the time of the victory of the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro, our leadership, our historical leadership of the revolution, precisely continued the route of the lessons learned from José Martí and all our real leaders. And from the very beginning of the revolution, Cuba started the process of solidarity, and that was solidarity in two fields. In the military field, when we have been involved, starting by Che Guevara, that, as you know, he has been part of the assistance to the guerrilla in Congo during the 60s. But also, so many other Cubans has been part of the assistance to the National Liberation Movement in and so many other countries in Africa, because to us that was clear that the only way to ensure justice and freedom in the world, that was through the independence of Africa, and to ensure the liberty, and to ensure that the Africans have the possibility to determine their own destiny. Cuba was very active, in particular, in the independence of the former Portuguese colonies. That was the reason when the independence of Angola came in the year 1975, Cubans were already there, because some of our national has been part of the solidarity expression and has been fighting side by side with the people of Angola against the colonialism and the fight for independence. And precisely, that was after that, in 1978 also, there was the presence of Cuban soldiers backing the Ethiopian people, when that was the time of the invasion by Somali troops, a dictatorship that existed at that time in Somalia, and that was trying to divide Ethiopia and to try to get the territory of Ogaden to be annexed to the territory of Ethiopia. But our position was very important, our presence was very important in Angola. Has been two main historical moments of the defeat. For the first time, I would like to say, that is most important, that has been not only the military and the strategic victory in the field, has been the ethical and the moral victory, showing that the apartheid regime that was not undefeatable, that can be beat and that can be defeated, because they have been imposing and they have been winning more and more influence in the southern part of Africa. And also it has been this complicity of some Western powers. That was this policy of so-called constructive engagement, that was to say to avoid that the Sanchez regime in South Africa was creating a lot of difficulties for their economy. And in particularly, as Fidel Castro said Also, that was the U.S. and Israel governments facilitating to the apartheid regime the use of nuclear weapons. During the time of the presence of Cuban fighters, the Cuban soldiers in Angola, we were also facing the threat of the use of nuclear weapons against our people. But we never have any doubt that we need to remain there and to be sharing the fortune and to be sharing the future of our brothers in Africa. In Africa, in Angola myself, I have the opportunity to be working closely with, in some training camp and in, even in the headquarters of the ANC, and on the SWAPO, because at that time has been two important liberation movements in the, that they have been having that kind of logistic support from Angola, has been also the fight of Namibia, and I think that the end of the apartheid regime was also important, because after that we have a new nation, that is the Namibia, that is now independent, and is also part and is also part of those developing countries that are united, working together for a better world in the future. That is the reason that, as I said, in 1975 we were already there. That was the South African troops of the apartheid regime. They have been coming very closely to Luanda. As a matter of fact, it was a very important fight and was very difficult. The Cuban soldiers at that time were part of very brave combats, and that was the, historically the starting point of the process. It has been referred by my brother Mamabolo, also was important the 80s. Well, that was a long period of always the apartheid regime backing the conservative groups, all those that would like to overcome the popular government of Angola. There has been so many years of fighters. As you know, Fidel Castro always said, from Africa, the only thing that we would like to have are the dead body of our soldiers. We never took any national resources. We never took any salary. We went, as a matter of fact, when I went to Angola at the end of the 80s, all of us, we were students at the university. We went there because all of us in Cuba to defend our revolution. We have military training in our university because it's a right and also it's a duty of every Cuban to defend our territory on the threat, on the military threat that we were facing for so many years, starting in the aperture of the Bay of Pigs, as you know, or Playa Girón, as we call in the beginning of the 60s. And we were at the university, and on the voluntary basis, we were not recruited, we were not paid, we were not offered any salary. As a matter of fact, at the time that I was in Angola, the only money that I was receiving, that was the same salary that I was supposed to be earning as I was working in Cuba, because in no way we were perceived on a basis of to be on a mercenary activity or to be on any kind of a military adventure. We were there only on the basis of our commitment, on our principal responsibility, that we need to go to Africa, we need to go to Angola to express our solidarity, and also on a reciprocity basis, taking into account the important role that the African descent took in the establishment of the Cuban nation, and also in the fight for our own independence. We have been there. We have been there for more than 10 years, has been in Africa in general around 2,000 people death. All those bodies we repatriated to Cuba. We, in 7 December, every year, we have a commemorative moment to all those that pass away. That is also the day that Antonio Maceo, a Cuban of African descent, pass away, and that is a very special day of commemoration for all the Cuban people. And every 7th of December, we pay tribute for all those Cubans that have been fighting and fighting for independence and fighting for justice in Africa. And I would like to say that I was meeting with our president, Raul Castro, at the time that the Secretary General of the UN was visiting Cuba some days ago. As you know, that was the summit of the Latin American and Caribbean community that took place in Havana that was very successful. So many leaders have been there. The isolation of Cuba that was totally defeated. And I remember that our president was very impressed for the way that the South African people, and in particular, he was referring, there was an order by Nelson Mandela, that the names of the Cuban fighters that passed away in Africa are there in the monument that has been created for those heroes of the fight against apartheid and the fight for a new democratic South Africa. But also, as you know, our solidarity and commitment with Africa, that is not only in the military field. We have been training and we were educating so many doctors, so many other graduates from the universities in Cuba. They are now some of that are ministers that are in a very high rank position in their countries. But in particular also, we have been having thousands of Cubans, particularly doctors, that has been working closely with the African countries to fight any kind of sickness, any kind of difficulties that they are confronting in the right to health. And also, I think that it's very important to know that the brotherhood and the sisterhood between Cuba and Africa is remaining, and that is not only an issue of history. I think that we are fighting together. I was myself very honored to participate in the Durban Summit against racism and racial discrimination that took place in Durban, and now it's precisely that we need to be so proud of the life of Nelson Mandela, because Nelson Mandela, at the time that he needed to be fighting using weapons, he did. And he was doing that kind of a struggle on the military basis. But he also was the founder of the new South Africa that is precisely the basis of a key player in so many areas, in particularly for the well-being of their own people, but also a key player and important partner in the defense of the common interest of developing countries and in the defense of the common interest of all people of the world. I would like to end, first of all, repeating what Raul Castro told in the memorial to Nelson Mandela. Honor and glory forever to the great comrade Nelson Mandela and to the heroic people of South Africa. Viva South Africa! Viva, viva Nelson Mandela! Viva Cuba!
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Scott Morgenthaler.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.